Captain Jones eases the canvas away, and at first they cannot think what it is they see. For it is brown and wizened like an apple, forgotten at the bottom of the barrel, or like the long-dead rats Mr. Hancock once found bricked up in the kitchen wall, parched and cured by the elements, skin that cracked under the pressure of a thumb. It is the size of an infant, and like an infant, its ribcage is delicate and pathetic beneath its parchment skin, and its head is large, and its fists are drawn up to its face. But this is as far as the comparison may be extended. For no infant has such fearful claws, and no infant such a snarl with such sharp fangs in it, and no infant's torso ends in the tail of a fish.
"I bought it from a Dutchman I met in Macau," says Tiso Jones, "and he from some Japanese fishermen who captured it alive. I'm sorry it has not survived."
"A vicious thing," says Suki.
"You don't know that?"
"I know how it looks."
By the time she goes to her bed tonight, she will have forgotten that it is dead. In her imagination, it already quivers with rage, clawing to escape a fishbowl, lashing the water in the face of its impotence. As surely as if she had seen it with her own eyes, she knows that the water around Java teems with thousands of little creatures just like it. She hears their hoarse cries and feels their fury.
"It can't harm you now,"
says Captain Jones, but she stares at him. He spreads his hands.
"Didn't I bring it all the way across the ocean? And it did not sink me, as they say mermaids do, and it did not bite me, as I know that apes do."
He chuckles, but she is not reassured.
"Come closer. You must take a better look."
They crowd in. There is a little squeak in the girl's breathing. They want to peer at it, inspect it, but at the same time they cannot but recoil. It is so perfectly dead.
"I don't see a single stitch on it," says Mr. Hancock at length.
"No glue, no paint. How is it done?"
"Done? You think it is done?"
Captain Jones is aggrieved.
"Like a conjuring trick? No, this is not done. It simply is. If it were done by any hand, 'twere gods alone."
He warms to his theme.
"After all the trouble I have taken, after I crossed half the earth twice, which is, in a practical sense, the entirety of the earth, when, sir, have I ever brought you counterfeit?" "No, never, never. Of course not. But you must appreciate that a mermaid, well, it is quite impossible." "Not so much as a blade of grass in all the tea I've ever borne safely to your warehouse,"
Captain Jones laments.
"No, no, no, I did not mean to imply..." "This is not a toy," says Captain Jones. "This is not a bauble. You cannot buy it at a fair. This is a genuine mermaid."
"I do see that."
"Take it in your hand, sir. Inspect it at your leisure. I assure you, you will not be disappointed."
It lies on the table, desiccated and furious, its mouth open in an eternal, apish scream. Mr. Hancock cannot help checking its little breast for the twitch of a pulse.
"Go ahead. It is your mermaid. Pick it up."
And so he must. He takes its tail in his two hands, and its scales rustle in his palms. It is so dry and so frail, he suddenly has a peculiar urge to dash it to the ground. But he does nothing.
"Complete, even to its fingernails,"
he whispers. There are wisps of silky black hair on its head. He cannot think what to feel. Surely this thing was a living being once.
But what am I to do with it? He ventures. This is not what I ordered. I shall have to disappoint a great many people. They must expect disappointment every now and then. That's the nature of our business.
But this is unprecedented. My ship is sold voluntarily by its captain, who uses the proceeds to buy, on my account, the most dismaying oddity. Who will sympathise with that? Who will invest in my ventures again if I cannot assure them my ship is in safe hands? Captain Jones rubs the back of his neck.
I did not think of that.
Exasperation fizzes.
Tyso! Tyso! 1.5 years you've had to think on it. You abandoned these knotty points to me, as you always have.
The tap of Suki biting her nail recalls to him that she and the maid still linger. Mr. Hancock does not mind discussing business in front of Bridget, who has neither the reason nor the interest to note it. But as for Suki...
Out goes,
he says, setting the mermaid down gently on the desk.
But may we not...
This is talk for men. You've your own duties to see to, have you not? Go.
Go!
He ushers them out, protesting anon. After bolting the door, he turns back to Captain Jones.
Why would you think this a cargo I would be glad to receive? I have no expertise. What expertise?
Captain Jones says sharply.
There is no expert in the world on this topic. It is a genuine mermaid. It'll want no extra work on your behalf. Only a fool could lose money on a mermaid.
He rakes his fingers through his hair.
Only a fool could be angry to get one.
But what am I to do with it?
Why, exhibit it. I am not a showman,
says Mr. Hancock primly.
I shall notify the Royal Society. This must be an important development for science, and I am not a scientific man either.
Captain Jones waves his hand in disgust.
And then how will you recoup your costs? Listen, 'tis common sense. Find a coffee house, charge a shilling per view, and say 300 viewer in a day. I'm being conservative. Why, that is £90 in a week.
Seeing Mr. Hancock shake his head, he hastens on.
You might tour the country with it. Take it to fairs. The province's appetite for such things has never been quenched.
90 a week, though? Wonders Mr. Hancock. He rents out each of the houses on Hancock Row, his modest empire of 6 dwellings on Butt Lane, for 35 shillings a month, and thinks himself rich.
4,000 a year. Again, I'm being conservative.
This figure takes his breath away. That such an insignificant thing might hold such riches.
And 'tis mine?
He croaks. He looks at the mermaid, where it lies, tiny and frail. Reaches to pick it up. Mistrusts his hands and retreats once more.
'Tis yours. Not your partner's, not your investor's, only yours.
He has nobody to consult with. His partner, Greaves, with whom he shares offices and sometimes ventures, has taken the Lorenzo to what now designs itself the United States. There is old business to salvage there, new opportunities to seize, but Mr. Hancock himself has no stomach for the America trade. Since the war, such defection feels personal and painful, and so his business with Greaves diverges evermore. Even if he were here, what could his advice be? Hester, then, what will she say to his acquiring such a freak?
The Hancocks have never run a circus.
Her voice intrudes as if she were there at her elbow.
We are reputable merchants of the finest wares. We do not deal in novelties. You will make us a laughing stock.
Mr. Hancock stares at it.
What did you spend on the damned thing?
He asks at length.
1,200. Now, do not look so. It was cheap at the price.
And you sold the ship for...
6,000.
To his credit, Captain Jones betrays some fear.
I had no choice. As God is my witness, you would have approved had you been there.
Mr. Hancock feels numbed, as if ice water filled his veins.
The Calliope was worth 8,000,
he says softly,
with her new mainmast.
The captain hangs his head.
I know it. She was a fine girl. I was sorry to part with her.
Mr. Hancock puts his hand to his face.
So why did you?
The captain takes a bill from his breast pocket and smooths it out carefully, holding it up to the light, his eyes conciliatory.
There's a strong box for you, with 4,800 in it, all accounted for after I paid off the crew. I'm an honest man.
He raises a hand to halt Mr. Hancock's indrawn breath, and continues with insistent cheer.
That will reimburse all your partner's investments on this voyage. You'll not lose face.
But you have lost me 2,000, and another 2,000 in goods as ought to have come back with you. And you have lost me my ship.
Hancock, I swear, the mermaid... 'Tis not a bag of magic beans, you know. There is real worth in this venture, if you'll only take a chance on it.
Mr. Hancock sighs.
I do not like chance. I try to be a steady man.
Well, 'tis out of your hands now.
Mr. Hancock could strike him. The man is so provoking in his optimism, as he declares,
Providence has taken your ship and given you a mermaid instead. You did that,
he rises.
Time you took your leave, I think.
He unbolts the door and passes ahead of his friend into the hall, where he finds the girls engaged in a level of industry unlike them even in broad daylight, and certainly at such an hour. Bridget dusts the banisters with vigour, and Suki counts and recounts the candles in their sconces.
Come, Hancock,
Captain Jones pursues undeterred.
Why not try it? Just for some little time. Recoup the cost of the ship, recoup it double, and then sell the little wretch on. It won't take no time.
Will you stay to eat?
Pipes Suki, making up for her earlier dumbness.
Or sleep here tonight? I can have a bed made up.
The guest bed is always made up, as she well knows. It only wants for Bridget to sprinkle the stale sheets with lavender water.
No, thank you. I'm anxious to return to my wife.
Captain Jones's smile is fond and sad.
I have not seen... the smallest of my children since it was 5 weeks old, and now I hear he's a hearty little fella, and can kick a ball and count to 18. I shall push on to Woolwich tonight, if it makes no odds to you.
His hand is on the latch. He steps out into the night.
Now, Hancock, think about what I've said.
Mr. Hancock turns his face away.
"Aye," he mumbles. "I'll think on it."
"We must celebrate this,"
Jones grins confidingly.
"I've a mind to show my face in London again. All through this voyage I was sustained by the memory of a happy few hours I spent at a bathhouse on Longacre. Is not a bagnio the perfect place to celebrate a mermaid?
Hush, you. There are girls indoors.
Good night, sir. Good night.
Mr. Hancock locks the door carefully. In the counting house, he finds Suki and Bridget squashed into his great chair at the desk, resting their chins on their arms as they stare at the mermaid. Bridget is yawning mightily, but Suki's frown is alert.
"Be gone," he says. "You're about my feet too much. It is time you were a bed."
"What is a bagnio?"
asks Suki, stretching her legs out before her.
"A place where gentlemen go to get cupped."
He shepherds them away from the desk,
and bled, and bathed, and such like. Healthful.
"I see."
She is taking the snuffer to the candles, while Bridget extinguishes those in the hall. He, nightlight in hand, bolts the shutters.
"And the mermaid," she continues, "will it make our fortune?"
"We do make our own fortunes."
"The sea captain said a great deal of money."
"Well, what does it signify? You're just a little girl of this house. If you are keeping the bills in order and timely, it is of no importance to you how much or how little else there is in the pot."
"Mother says 'tis a dreadful discourtesy to keep women out of the accounts, for if they're to be ruined, they've a right to know about it."
"Nobody is to be ruined," he grunts, "and you are to tell your mother none of this."
"It is all of our concern. My papa's investment."
"His investment is safe. If it is not, he may take it up with me himself. Now I'll hear no more about it."
She turns as she stands at the very last candle, half her face lit up and her hair floating in illuminated wisps. Her eyes flick to the dark desk, where the mermaid's crooked fingers are silhouetted.
"And do we just leave it in here all night?"
"Why, 'tis not going anywhere."
She shudders and brings the snuffer down on the flame. He makes his habitual nightly round of the house, candle aloft, through the kitchen to bolt the doors and shutters there, while Bridget makes ready her cot in the corner, then up the stairs with Suki's skirts rustling at his heels to see that all is secure. They do not speak as they damp down the fire in the parlour and make fast the door leading to the attic, so no thief, picking his way along the rooftops, may opportune himself. When all is tight and dark, Mr. Hancock repairs to his room on the second floor and draws the bolt to. He hangs his breeches and stockings on the chair as the building relaxes into silence, the grunt and sigh of its joists, the blunder of the wind in its chimneys. He is parting the curtains of his bed when he hears the stairs creak. He stops and strains to listen. They creak again. Closer. At the turn of the stair before the first floor, he judges, where the banister rail rattles in its fitting. From the locked and lightless rooms below, something approaches. With his shirt hanging about his knees, he goes to the door and listens. Somewhere below him, a tap, a scratch, a fingertip on wood. Through the floorboards he hears Suki whimper. She has heard it too. Now she is moving across her own bedroom floor. The nape of his neck prickles. Surely she will not investigate. He is charged with protecting her, and yet even as her latch clicks, he is rooted to the spot. A whisper below.
"I'm so glad you're awake."
It is Bridget. Of course. Who else would it be? What other souls wander the house at this hour?
"You scared the wits out of me,"
Suki hisses.
"Think how I feel. I'll not sleep a wink
with that thing so nearby?
Ain't it peculiar? It's not Christian. Anybody can see. Now, Suki, what if it comes for us?
Bunk in with me. We'll take turns sleeping while the other sits watch. Now, hush, hush. Don't wake Uncle.
And the latch clicks closed. Below, he hears them whispering yet, excited sibilances that dissolve into silence. Closing his eyes to his candle, he seeks the sense of young Henry, some friendly companion to stand with him in the dark. But nothing comes. He takes to his bed alone. Chapter 4
Eliza!
It is noon, and Angelica is awake. After Mrs. Frost left her, she entertained a group of gentlemen with much merriment until 3 in the morning. She sits up in bed hot and cross, and desirous of a saucer of tea.
Eliza!
She calls again. There is no answer. She rises, her chemise wrinkled and bunched about her thighs, and trots into the dressing room. The table is still skewed in the middle of the floor, and Mrs. Frost's cot is cold and empty, the counterpane pulled up smooth to the bolster.
Now surely she cannot have stayed out all night,
mutters Angelica.
But where would she go?
She does not allow herself to think. Perhaps she does not mean to come back. But the notion nevertheless flutters behind her ribs. She walks into the parlour, which is disordered from the night's doings, the cushions tumbled on the sofa, and scattered glasses sticky with ratafia, and even into the scullery, sighing,
Eliza! Eliza!
For she already knows her search will be fruitless. This has never happened before, nor anything at all like it. She stands in the middle of her large room and tugs at her fingers until the joints go pop. Her old friend, Belle Fortescue, will call for her soon, and the eyes of old friends are the keenest of all. Furthermore, while Angelica's aristocratic keeper is reduced to worm fodder, Belle's is vital and prospering, and cherishes her as passionately now as the day he first met her.
"I'll not be her sorry friend," mutters Angelica. "I am every bit as good as her."
And yet she has been abandoned to manage her appearance all alone. Her curls are still fresh, and want only a fluffing, which is hardly beyond her powers. And she casts about for what she can wear that might be donned without Mrs. Frost's helpful hands and careful eyes. What a boon, then, is her own Perdita gown, for once she has pressed her waist into the faithful clasp of her pink silk stays, she affects the gathers of white muslin with only little trouble, and conceals her mistakes with a wide blue sash. Lesser women might take fright at so scant and humble a gown, but Angelica, lovely in both face and figure, requires no embellishment of dress. She is easy as a nymph in her soft drapery.
"And so 'twas more easily done than I feared,"
she congratulates herself as she crouches before her displaced dressing table, tapping rouge into her cheeks. And she is well satisfied with herself, and misses her companion not one bit. Belle Fortescue, when Angelica climbs into her carriage, surveys her gauzy dress with only a flicker of humour.
"What nakedness, Jelly,"
she murmurs, for she is naturally soulful, even in amusement. She is a small little woman with treacle-brown eyes, a comrade in the Cyprian Corps for 10 years or more. Her face is round and her chin is pointed. She has a little flat nose like a child's, and her hands are childlike too, small and tidy. Men have wept for her grave sweetness, but if any have come to her in the hope that she will be like a child in all respects, they have been disappointed. For even as a girl of 16, Belle was a queen of self-possession, as a grown woman, she is untouchable. Her clever Earl, although he has furnished her home and filled her library, dares not beg entry to her bed.
What? This?
Angelica plucks at her muslin, kept upon her body by such slim strings.
I think it the most practical thing I ever came upon. So simple. So light.
So simple and light, says Belle. 'Tis hardly there at all.
I have worn less.
Not on the mall. Angelica puts her nose in the air. Oh, dear heart, says Belle Fortescue warmly. I am glad to see you so much yourself. In the depths of her dispossession, Angelica once allowed herself to weep sincerely in her friend's presence. This was a mistake, for Belle now searches her face for sorrow with a great intensity, and puts a hand on her arm. You are well, are you not?
Oh, most robustly!
The carriage is built so as to be smooth in its movements and almost silent, done up in pink silk so they nestle like pearls in an oyster shell. Its windows are small and curtained, but Angelica peeps out as they roll past the great things of Piccadilly.
Now, Belle, who is about? You must tell me. There are a great many old friends I'm anxious to restore my connection with.
'Tis very quiet as yet. Parliament ain't yet convened. Nobody of remark is returned for the season. You could afford to stay a little longer in seclusion, if your nerves... Belle's solicitude is too much.
I'm here, am I not? Perhaps it were better I arrived before the rush. I do not like to be the last person into a room.
Nobody would have blamed you, Belle persists, if you had remained in the countryside. We understand.
Ugh! I had died if I had stayed there one moment longer. I do not like the countryside, Belle. There are too many animals, and the light is not flattering.
But you know that you...
And how low the ceilings are there! Why, I'm glad to be back in the midst of things. Where are we going?
Berkeley Square. Belle's eyes shine. I am taking you to Negri's to feed you sweetmeats.
Oh, Belle!
Angelica clasps her hands. I know what you like. Jellies, syllabubs, biscuits. I dare say there are few enough of those in the countryside.
Here, has Mrs. Chapel visited you lately?
Ah!
Now we get to the heart of it. And what is it to you?
I'm interested. Were I still a gambling woman, I'd hedge that she would get her claws back into you once you were at liberty. Angelica sighs.
She came yesterday.
And you told her?
I refused to go back to her.
Mrs. Fortescue is entirely too polite a person to laugh or grin immoderately, but she straightens the flounce at Angelica's shoulder.
Good.
Angelica, for the first time, catches her amusement.
Belle, think what it would be like, she exclaims, at my age, being as I am.
A poor choice, nods Belle soberly. A most diminishing choice.
She will let me set my own prices, and I'll dine at her table, and we'll be best of friends.
And then she'll invoice you sixpence for the bowl of oranges she put in your room.
Yes, indeed, and as a kindness, she'll have her woman get a stain out of my dress.
So that'll be half a crown on your account.
And every time I take a glass of sherry, she'll make a note.
The fresh bedclothes, oh, do you remember?
Clean sheets every day.
It has been a long time since Angelica last had the opportunity to air her grievances, and she snatches joyfully at her friend's hand.
She would keep me her slave by the laundry bills alone. If my duke had not bought me out the last time,
I cannot think I would ever have got away. Belle, I cannot do it again. I cannot be so servile. Am I wrong? Is this my most prudent choice?
No, no. If we had wanted to be so closeted, we would have stayed at home in our villages, ain't that so? Besides, she glances quickly at Angelica, I begin to suspect Mother Chapel is losing her touch. This is too far for Angelica to follow her.
Oh, no,
she says, shaking her head.
No, I do not think that can be so. Mrs. Chapel is the premier abbess in all of London.
She was, says Belle. She's an old woman now. She cannot fathom the desires of the world as she could 20 years ago. There are younger madams coming up, while she depends on her old faithfuls.
Thought animates her little person as she speaks. Now her eyebrows lower in a frown. Now she spreads her palms as if to gauge the balance of her argument.
Of course, she has as fine an eye for beauty as ever she did, but lately I see she also has an eye for girls who will do as they are taught and no more. They do not transcend her the way they used to, the way they ought to. They are the most cultivated and educated whores in London. But a whore is a whore is a whore. Ain't that so?
I dare say, says Angelica. Why does she want me, then?
You, says Belle, have a genius that cannot be taught.
Angelica wriggles in her seat.
I do?
Yes, 'tis what makes you a courtesan, and not a jade.
She leans forward in her seat.
Mother Chapel no longer dares take on girls with that genius, for she is afraid she cannot mould them. She hopes your attachment to her will make you biddable. That is precisely why you must not return to her.
Oh, she thinks for a moment. Eliza says I ought.
A shadow of disdain touches Belle's face.
You still keep her with you?
She has nobody else.
Angelica does not mention Mrs. Frost's defection. She does not wish even to think of it.
She is a fearful woman, hisses Belle, seizing her wrist. She seeks to make you less than what you could be, as Mrs. Chapel does. This is the problem with women. Men are not fearful. They build one another to greatness. Women believe their only power is in tearing one another down.
Quite, quite. So I need your help. If I am to remain independent from Mrs. Chapel, I'd better start making independent connections.
I know a gentleman. Not your sort, Belle adds hastily. But he admires you, and you might favour him with a few hours' company. The playhouses are opening again, are they not? Well, he has a box at Drury Lane.
A good box? Angelica asks suspiciously. One fit for me to be seen in?
You never wonder whether you are fit to be seen in it.
Fool, I know I am. I am fit to be seen in the box of the Prince of Wales himself, if he would only extend me the invitation.
Mr. Jennings will have you, I know, says Belle. He is a rogue, but not so much of a rogue. If your object is merely to broadcast your return, he will suit you very well. I shall write and have him keep a seat for you tonight.
Angelica squeaks.
Oh, Belle, thank you.
Only behave yourself, and do not give me cause to regret it.
The carriage grumbles to a stop in the shade of Berkeley Square, and Belle's face clears like rain clouds chased away.
And, we are arrived. What will you have? My man can run in for the order.
What? And lose the pleasure of browsing?
Berkeley Square is a parade ground waiting for Angelica's feet.
I want to go in there myself. Oh, please, do not make me. I cannot bear to be looked upon any more. Come, Belle. Why can we not take it away and eat it in the carriage? Because that is not why we are here.
Angelica's mouth takes a stubborn set. Belle affects not to see, but she cannot ignore her friend's hand tightening on her wrist. Angelica takes a breath.
I've been away so long, Belle, she says,
and now she breaks her gaze.
I need this. Oh, Jelly.
As they descend, people turn to look at them. Genteel girls nudge one another, and wives touch their husbands' shoulders.
Do you mark that? Whispers Angelica. We are retreated from the world, and yet still we are not forgot. Don't it please you?
Not particularly, says Mrs. Fortescue. They have left off abusing me as a Jezebel. I suppose that's something.
I like it,
says Angelica, shifting her hips so the soft froth of her dress swirls around her legs, which are entirely naked, save for her stockings and slip and two layers of muslin. What a thing it is to be walking once again in London, furthermore in the company of the most gossiped-of lady in town, and looked at, looked at, looked at. The bubbled glass window of the confectioner's is lined with tall jars filled with sugar plums of all kinds, all lacquered and sunrise-tinted, and a multitude of sugar sculptures that shimmer like ice, and a palace cast from jelly, glass clear, with tiny air bubbles frozen about the red currants and apricots and grapes suspended within. Inside, it is a veritable temple to sugar, which betrays nothing of the heat and toil, the boiling and skimming and coaxing and measuring that must go into its making. Everything here is cool and sparkling, with knots of gentlewomen and men chattering cordially at the marble tables. The back wall is lined with bottled liqueurs and syrups of all colours and all flavours, bergamot, muscadine, cinnabar, rose, and frothy-headed syllabubs are lined up on slabs of chilly marble, and from the back room comes an endless procession of fine things. Striped jellies are borne forth to the chattering diners beyond, sparkling sherbets, little frozen bombs and mice and lions and turrets. On the counter, glass salvers are piled with cakes and fancies, tiny amber caramels and tarts of translucent custard, and leathery fruit-paste jumbles contrived in true-love knots. Angelica's favourites are the mi-fruits, crisp clouds fragrant with orange water, their surfaces rugged with cochineal and gold leaf and almonds and Angelico.
Like jewels, she sighs. Delicious little carbuncles. I shall take some home with me.
She knows from the air of the room that she is being watched and listened to. The conversation is not the same busy lapping it was when first she entered it. And as she moves towards the fruit display, she hears the rustle of sleeves and cravats as their owners shift to keep their view. The confectioners, although their real talent lies in marrying fruit to alcohol, sugar, cream, are wise enough to present the finest offerings from London's gardens and hothouses in their most virgin state. Peaches and plums, ripe to bursting, tangles of red currants, polished strawberries, melons breathing their musk out in great waves, pineapples wound about most artfully with vines.
Oh, pineapples, Angelica cries. Belle, I want one.
Now is your chance. Angelica colours, charming in any woman, let alone one of such beguiling embonpoint, and lowers her voice to a plaintive whisper.
Eliza will not be pleased. That woman is not your keeper, hisses Belle. Buy a pineapple.
She says such things make trouble. Well, that is what pays her way. If you did not need an attendant, she would be sewing sheets in a garret. Oh, but she's a tyrant with the purse strings. She says in our... And now she only mouths the words. Current situation. We must forego luxuries. Then she's a fool. Even if you have nothing else, you must have luxuries. What, would she have the world see you eking out peas porridge for your meals? She sighs. Well, so be it. There is one way left to get it. Angelica's lips twitch up at the corners. Really? You think it will work after so long? Of course. Angelica looks about herself to gauge the attention of the room. And yes, the eyes of the customers flick discreetly over her, not only the women peeping over their almond biscuits, but the men too, and some of them, she sees, are of the first water. She draws a deep breath.
Pineapples,
she says, with a penetrating coquetry,
are my favourites.
Belle's eyes are shining, and she continues with renewed enthusiasm.
To my mind, they are the finest of all fruit. I wish I had one, that I might enjoy it at my leisure. Come away, Mrs. Neal, cries Belle with a shudder. I cannot stand the sight of the horrid things. I will not have one in my carriage. Would you deprive me of my pleasure? Aye, madam, I would. You will go without today.
They turn away, and Mrs. Fortescue raises an eyebrow.
Well played, she whispers. You think it will work? Wait and see.
Chapter 5. Mr. Hancock has been in and out of the coffee houses around the exchange for 30 years. It does not take him long to light upon one in which to show his mermaid. It was once a favourite of his father's, and to those with long memories and moderate imagination, has a reputation as the place to overhear great discourse on biology. The level of debate therein is not now what it once was, it serving mainly middle-aged merchants who flatter themselves on their scientific bent, and what man of some means is not nowadays a man of science. It is known as the pineapple, so called, says its proprietor, Mr. Murray, for this was the first place in all of London where such a fruit could be tasted of, and since then we've displayed all sorts of wonders to the satisfaction of all. Miss Jermy, patched black and white like a cow, she was one of ours, and the little lad with feet for hands and hands for feet, the Lord rest him, and the African mask with a terrible curse on it, and that little white fox destroyed the wainscoting. He adds regretfully, I shall be wanting a deposit from ye in case of damage. I cannot imagine it will cause you any trouble of that sort. I've heard that before. What of its diet? And how large is its tank? Why, it is not alive, said Mr. Hancock. He has swaddled it in an Indian shawl, as once belonged to his mother, and in the office of the coffee house he unwraps it with some ceremony. He expects surprise from Mr. Murray, but he betrays none as he inspects it. He looks at it as if it were no less ordinary than a bushel of apples, although he has the courtesy to wipe his hands upon his breeches before picking it up. I see, he says. More of a sea goblin, ain't it? That's what I'd call it. Its appearance is unlovely. Do you think it will draw any crowd? Why would it not? A marvel's a marvel. He taps his nose wisely. To my mind, its ugliness adds to its appeal. Folks don't mind being scared when they know there's a pie and gossip to be had downstairs. And so, would you have it? Aye, why not? We'll call it a mermaid, draw women,
and I get 20%.
Chapter 6 Mrs. Fortescue chooses a jelly, Rosolio pink. At their table, she traces the rim of her spoon against its surface before piercing it with slow purpose. She puts a morsel to her mouth and meditates on it. Angelica, delving into the sweet wine under her syllabub, is silent too. She would have liked to sit further into the middle of the room, where she might be admired from more angles, but Belle's patience for spectacle has been exhausted already. "I have something to tell you," she says. "Shh! Now do not make anything of it. I do not want these people's attention." "Well?" Mrs. Fortescue bounces her spoon against the taut jelly. "I may get married."
"Oh! Shh! Hush! Don't raise your voice."
Angelica looks about her furtively and leans forward to whisper.
"To Lord, do not say his name here."
Belle draws herself up, her eyes blaze warning.
"I cannot stand to be the subject of any more gossip."
Her voice is gentler as she continues, glancing about herself.
"Of course, to his lordship. I have not been in the keeping of anybody else these last 3 years, have I? And the Countess died this spring, so really, there is no obstacle."
"I see obstacles," growls Angelica. "I see what he is and what you are."
"I will be whatever I choose to make myself. Have I not come this far?"
She puts down her spoon.
"You!"
"What do you mean by that?"
"You do not remember what you used to say? Never shall I be a wife, Jelly."
She affects a stern little frown and wags her finger, although her voice trembles unaccountably.
"For that is a life of servitude, and servitude I do denounce."
Belle gives a little sigh and taps her bottom lip with the bowl of her spoon.
"I denounced it, but it did not denounce me. I have all my life sought freedom for myself, but now I think, the world being what it is, that freedom cannot be got. More expedient, do you not think, to choose its best imitator?"
"But you are already well set," says Angelica. "A fine house, all of your own, and a carriage to drive where you will. He's even let you keep your friends."
"Aye, indeed, and I read as I wish, and he's not afraid for me to meet men if I find them interesting or useful to my learning."
"So how can it be better? What would you wish changed?"
Belle knits her chocolate-brown eyebrows.
"'Tis not secure."
"Money is its own security."
"And how am I to come upon that when I grow old and ugly, and he casts me off? I've nothing in my own name. Have you any savings put aside?"
"Not a penny."
"So what do you suppose will happen? We cannot be novelties all our lives."
She spreads her hands beseechingly.
"Jelly, he asked."
"And you said yes?"
Angelica is stung, although she cannot say quite why. It is as if Belle has laughed off a vow that Angelica imagined they both took with equal solemnity. She looks about the confectioners nervously, for in her surprise she has forgotten to modulate her expressions and her movements. She would not like to be observed as uncomfortable.
"Dear heart, dear jelly,"
Belle sighs,
"I've tried all other kinds of prostitution. Why not this? 'Tis simply the best contract I ever saw drawn up, and its terms are for life."
"His life or yours?"
Angelica scowls into the curds of her syllabub. That's not for me to guess.
"'Twill be yours, if he gets a baby on you,' says Angelica. "'Those little hips weren't built to bear much.'
"'Well, so be it. It cannot be said I passed my life idle, nor unexamined.
"'Can we leave this place? I want some air.'
"'Of course, of course. A turn around the square?' Belle's voice is kind and coaxing. "'A peek in the jeweller's windows? What say you?'
"'Oh, very well.'
They depart with their arms linked.
"'I have missed your company, Jelly,' whispers Belle. "'Truly, although your tempers are hot, and never what you claim them to be.'
She returns to her apartment to find a great pineapple waiting for her outside its door, with a card bearing the regards of Mr. Such-and-Such, who begs her forgiveness but happened to observe this afternoon— extends this gift as a token of his warmest friendship, etc., etc., etc. But still no Mrs. Frost. The living room is still in disarray, its curtains still drawn, and its crockery still soiled and scattered. Observing this, and feeling the sting of a double abandonment, Angelica comes close to weeping.
"'This is worrisome,' she says aloud. "'Perhaps she's been hurt, or drugged. "'Perhaps she don't realise I have need of her. "'Surely there is some way I might send for her.'
"'But they are so very rarely apart, "'this eventuality has never arisen before. "'And besides, Angelica has never so much as wondered "'where her companion might go when she is not by her side. "'As an hour passes, she begins to fret.'
"'For I am to be seen at the theatre tonight,' she laments. "'And I cannot very well dress myself for that.'
"'She paces the room, wringing her hands, "'until the girls trading on the ground floor "'protest at her ill use of the floorboards "'by banging up with a broom handle. "'Then she strips off her gauzy smock "'and her silk slip as smooth as skin "'and lets them fall under her feet,' since there is nobody present to collect them up. She sets about lacing up her hefty court stays with much tugging and panting, but first they are skewed to one side and then to the other. Then the tape snaps in her hand and she shrieks with rage. There is a little tap on the door.
"'Eliza!'
she calls hopefully, but it is only Maria, their maid, who sleeps in the scullery and eats their crusts.
"'Where is Mrs. Frost?'
demands Angelica.
"'Sent me, Mum. "'I see that. "'Did she tell you where she would be?'
"'Not my business.
"'Tis my business. "'You might tell me.'
Angelica presses a sixpence meaningfully into Maria's hand, but after briefly inspecting it, the girl pockets it and says not another word.
"'Christ almighty!' says Angelica. "'If I were your mother, I'd have drowned you at birth. "'You had better lace me in, then. "'Wash your hands first. "'My word, at least wipe them. "'This silk costs more than your year's wages.'
"'Since Maria is too stupid to help carry the table, "'they must prepare Angelica in the cramped dressing room.
"'Now smooth it in,'
says Angelica, opening the jar of pomade.
"'Just a little at a time. "'Is that within your powers?'
But it is not. Maria is confounded by every item she comes across. She showers the room with hair powder and boxes Angelica's ear with the bellows. Her attempts to heap and pin Angelica's hair into place gives her the appearance of a haystack in a gale. She spears her thumb with a jewelled pin and blots the blood on Angelica's best kid gloves.
"'This will not do!'
says Angelica. She feels the tears coming and chooses rage instead.
"'Useless, unhelpful girl!'
Maria upturns a bottle of rouge onto the rug.
"'I cannot bear this! Why, you're fit for nothing! I'm better off by myself!'
"'Or with another assistant,' says Mrs. Frost, who stands in the doorway of the dressing room, shaking out her shawl.
Oh, Eliza! Eliza! At last you're here! What am I to do?
Rattles Angelica.
Belle has arranged for me to go to the theatre, and I'm a state! You must help me!
By the sour look of her friend's face, she is not yet forgiven. But I will let her have her temper, thinks Angelica, since it don't inconvenience me.
Out,
says Mrs. Frost to Maria, who retreats at pace.
We can save this,
she continues, and sets about tousling the powder through Angelica's abused hair with quick, deft hands. And she paints her friend's face, and pins and hooks, and stitches her into her layers of petticoats and skirts. She must stoop before the transformed Angelica to secure the jacket of her gaudy, striped redding coat. She grasps her at the waist and runs pin after pin through the silk and into her stays.
You came back,
says Angelica, and Mrs. Frost sticks her again right above where her soft navel must be, until she feels the shaft of the pin come up hard against whalebone.
Do you think I would abandon you?
Oh, not forever, but...
Angelica allows herself a laugh.
I thought you meant to hurt me a little.
I would not do that.
Mrs. Frost is still terse.
You are a good friend. We may have our differences in opinion, but...
One more thing.
Mrs. Frost seizes a long ivory busk from the dressing table and rams it down Angelica's front with such briskness that she staggers.
There. Now I'm satisfied you're fit to be seen.
Angelica sighs with pleasure at her reflection.
Oh, Eliza, my love, you know I cannot be grand without you.
And this provokes a little smile. When Angelica returns, it is almost dawn, and her link boy is so tired that he can barely run before the chair, but trudges alongside it, taking the weight of his guttering torch in both hands and upon his shoulder, so that it sizzles and spits alarmingly close to the too large wig that swivels about on his head and every now and then slides down over his eyes. At her door, she is overcome by charity for the poor child and gives him a shilling.
I shall not account for that to Eliza,
she thinks with a little triumph.
How provoking she will find it to have her books out of order by so small a sum.
The ground floor rooms of her lodgings present as a mantua maker's, but down the passage a woman's moans are audible, and the squeaking of a bed frame rises in rapidity and vigour.
So somebody's work is soon to be done,
she thinks as she climbs the stairs, which idea she finds comforting, as if she were part of a great, benevolent order. The whore's day ends as the baker's begins, and there is a time for every purpose under heaven. This present moment's purpose is reconciliation, and she goes direct to the dressing room, where Eliza Frost sleeps flat on her back with her toes turned up and her arms at her sides. Her plain white smock, ruffled at the neck and wrists, does not detract from her resemblance to a corpse freshly laid out. She does not groan or grope about when awakened. Her eyes flick open in silence, and she turns her face calmly to the door.
Good morning, Slugabed,
Angelica hisses.
Here I am, alone. Come and keep company with me.
Mrs. Frost follows her into the bedroom and lights a candle, while Angelica kicks her shoes under the wardrobe and sets about peeling her stockings off.
Ay me, what a night, what a night! I was grateful you did me up so marvellous fine, for Mr. Jennings's box may be clearly viewed from all parts of the theatre. One might have believed that I was the sole entertainment.
Mrs. Frost helps her out of her striped gown while she chatters on.
In fact, there was one woman spent the whole evening staring at my hair and clothing, and in the third act she took out her pocketbook right there in the theatre and made a little note to herself. Imagine!
It was almost too flattering. I was not moved to make any notes myself, for I believe there was not one woman there better presented than I.
How was the play? Asked Mrs. Frost. Did you take in even a line of it?
Oh, I regret I watched a great deal too much of it. Knowing I was only invited there for one night, I should have looked more about myself. I believe I missed some gossip. I must find a gentleman who has a good box, Eliza, and who will let me sit in it every night. That way I need pay no mind to the play, unless there is really nothing else to see.
She sighs mightily.
I am at least satisfied that I myself received attention of the most felicitous sort. You may be sure that everybody knows I am in town, and I would not be surprised if I now receive a great flood of invitations. Then what?
She wears only her white lawn chemise now, her body a shadow beneath it as she fills the basin from the ewer. Mrs. Frost is shaking out the mantua and petticoats, checking them over for rips and stains before putting them aside to be sponged in the morning.
Oh, then dancing, and then the men were playing at cards. I did not put any money down. You need not worry about that. I merely acted as Mr. Jennings' luck, and he did very well by me. Mark you,
I did well by him, too. She puts her foot up on a stool, and the candlelight glows in the filaments of fine hair on her thighs as she rinses her commodity.
My pocket is on the chaise. I think you will be pleased by the sum you find in it.
They slip under the sheets. Angelica curls up like a little creature. But Mrs. Frost is wide awake. She rolls onto her side and says, as if there has been no break in conversation,
"You will not consider it."
"What? Oh, not now, Eliza. Let me sleep."
But Mrs. Frost is set on it.
"You are fortunate that Mrs. Chapel would still have you."
"I'll not go back to a bawdy house."
"Not any bawdy house,"
Mrs. Frost says, pleadingly.
"All cats are grey with the candles out. Comes down to the same thing."
The relief of being in her own bed and wrapped in the arms of sleep makes her soft and affectionate. She wriggles close to her friend.
"I know you think it is the prudent thing to do," she mumbles, "but if I go back there, I may never get out again. At least not before I'm old and rattled and poxed, and she discards me as so much trash."
"You will command higher fees,"
Mrs. Frost perseveres as her friend throws an arm across her.
"You can earn your way out in a moment."
"She will never allow that to happen."
"Why not consider it?"
Angelica, cross, must surface again from her pillows.
"You make me sorry that I brought you in here. This is a delicate moment for me, which Mother Chapel apprehends quite as well as I do. I can return to a brothel, or I can seize my liberty. The doings of tonight make me surer than ever that I shall do well."
"'Tis the rent I worry about."
Angelica's irritation gets the better of her.
"So go down onto the street and start earning it yourself. Go on. A clean-looking woman like you, well-spoken, you might make 2 shillings before breakfast."
Mrs. Frost blanches. Angelica's eyes are wide again, enamel blue.
"No?"
she asks.
"You don't like that idea?"
"That is not the arrangement,"
mutters Mrs. Frost.
"No, this is the arrangement, isn't it? And if you don't like it..."
Mrs. Frost hangs her head.
"Yes, dear, you can go back to your husband."
She narrows her eyes.
"Oh, forgive me. You would have to find him first."
"I'll not stand for this."
Mrs. Frost is out of the bed and making for the door.
"But you do,"
Angelica mocks her.
"You always do. You purport to disdain this life, and yet you always return to it. What am I to make of that?"
And then she is satisfied, and she falls asleep without another thought.